Give me another minute here. I'm trying to be Zoom tech and teacher and all of that at the same time. So I am still getting set up here. Okay. Can everybody hear me? All right. I will begin by greeting everyone, starting with the folks on Zoom. That would be Bob, Mark, Andy, Yeshetsoki, Joseph, Marv, Shoketsu, Phil, John, Karen, Pat, Brian, Amelia, Ellen, Deborah, Travis, Sabrina, Ruthann, and then in the Zendo, I'll let people say the room name. Linda, Katie,
Jim,
and me. Okay. Announcements. You can come here in person as well as online. We will have a holiday break. We will miss 2 Tuesday meetings and 1 Sunday meeting. So look at the calendar. Also, let's see, one more Tuesday class on the 9 Fields of Zen practice. We'll be ending with Bodhisattva activity. And then we'll be moving on to a new series, and we'll be reading Kyogen Carlson's book, You Are Still Here. So that's one of my teachers. And we won't read every chapter, and some of the chapters I've already given a talk on and stuff. So see the website for, you know, which chapter we'll be reading each week. And I think I have the calendar done, I think, through January, and we'll see how we feel at that point, if we want to move on to some other topic or not. Can Zoom people hear me pretty well? Okay. All right. I think it was yesterday that my husband asked me what I was going to talk about today, and I'm like, I don't know, because I plan it on Sunday morning, so I get up extra early, and there's many Dharma topics I can talk about, but then I felt like I should offer something a little bit, I don't know but if topical is the right word, but something that addresses something about the state of our country. So I'm calling this Practicing When Your Country is Broken. I've heard that particular phrase, I've said that particular phrase quite a number of times recently, and I've heard it in the media, and I've heard it on social media, and heard it from other people that I know, just this, and if you if you don't think our country is broken, then I'd be happy to have a conversation with you about your perspective. And it's always been a matter of degree, right? I mean, every age thinks, oh no, things are going to hell in a handbasket. It's terrible. Sometimes it's helpful to read history and reflect on, yeah, there's always been division. There's always been conflict. There's always been injustice, da, 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 da. But I think we're approaching a new degree of brokenness when it becomes perfectly legal for someone to travel to a turbulent protest as an armed vigilante and then shoot and kill anyone that they encounter that acts aggressively. A new degree of brokenness when there was an overt attack on our national capital, encouraged by the sitting president in order to overturn the results of an election. A new degree of brokenness when voting restrictions and gerrymandering guarantee the power of a party where it would in many cases not otherwise win elections. And it's troubling to look around the world and see there aren't very many places doing any better than we are, and sometimes worse. I mean, on the other hand, you know, we do live in a country where I can give a talk about how our country is broken and not disappear in the middle of the night. So there are many, many, many things to be grateful for as well. Let's see, it looks like there was another message about that sometimes the video or audio is skipping a little bit. I like looking out at your Zoom faces. But if you are personally experiencing that, you might turn off your own video and you'll have more bandwidth to work with. But, you know, if you're not having a problem, stay on because it's nice to see you. All right. But I'm not here to talk about the state of our country. I'm just guessing that you are at least to some degree distressed, angry, outraged, disappointed, or fearful, like I am. And I'm not here to convince you things are going to get better. It's my responsibility as a Zen teacher to offer you something helpful in these difficult circumstances. But a rosy vision of worldly progress, of increasing justice and peace and democracy, it's not something Buddhism offers. Instead, Buddhism's reflections on the state of the world are and always have been, what did you expect? Now, from a social justice point of view, this could be seen as a potentially dangerous and negative point of view, suggesting we can't or shouldn't do anything about the state of the world. But if you set aside that for a moment, the question of what we should do from here on out, and reflect instead on your current state of body and mind, the question, what did you expect, can be helpful. So a situation can be painful, stressful, troubling, scary, horrifying. But from the Buddhist point of view, this is pain. This is just part of life. And in the Pali Sutras, they say this is like being pierced by an arrow. Ouch. But what we usually do is we pierce ourselves with a second arrow. And we make things much worse. Thinking this, you know, why are things like this? Things shouldn't be like this. A resistance to the very fact that they have come about. What did you expect? Who said? Who gave us a guarantee? Even if we feel promises were made, why do we think anyone has the power to make those promises? in one of our lineage's texts by Bodhidharma called Outline of Practice. Bodhidharma says, the sutras say, when you meet with adversity, don't be upset, because it makes sense. With such understanding, you're in harmony with reason, and by suffering injustice, you enter the path. Now, this doesn't mean you deserve it, or this adversity was preordained and there's nothing you can do to improve things. But it does mean that a whole infinite web of causes and conditions led to this moment and the set of circumstances. One thing led to another, and here we are. There's no use in wringing your hands about what might have been, or clinging to your ideas about the rules that are supposed to be, that's supposed to govern worldly affairs, no matter how just and appropriate those rules are. Here we are. And some measure of relief of body and mind can come from accepting that instead of resisting it. We don't have to accept this set of circumstances from here on out. We can do something, we can try to do something about it, which I'm going to be talking about. But acceptance of the causes and conditions that have led up to this moment is nothing we can change. So then what? Zen, in Buddhism, Zen does not tell us what we should do, but how we should do it. Or in other words, Zen prepares us to respond in a way that fulfills our greatest potential. The best response, the best effort, most intelligent thing, the most compassionate thing that you are capable of, we're working to, you know, make ourselves capable of that. We aim to put ourselves in the best possible state to maintain our equanimity, to think clearly, to respond appropriately. So as I've talked about before, my recipe, so this isn't a traditional Buddhist teaching, but it's a recipe out of traditional Buddhist ingredients, includes three main ingredients or categories of ingredients. Bearing witness, taking care, and taking action. So bearing witness is just, it's exposing ourselves to the suffering in the world in all its forms. Momentarily setting aside what it is we can do about it or whether we can do anything about it. Taking care is engaging in activities, relationships, practices that nourish and sustain us. Taking action is participating in a tangible way in the world to try to help alleviate or prevent suffering. So creating a sustainable, vital, generous bodhisattva practice means including all three of these ingredients. And it's a dynamic process. Sometimes you're going to be focusing on one ingredient. You might be have health problems and responsibilities for family members and all kinds of stuff, and taking care might just be like, you know, about all you can do. But sometimes you have more time and you might be able to bear witness and take action. And, you know, ideally we have all three ingredients. So in terms of bearing witness with respect to what we're talking about today, practicing where our country is broken, many times what's most troubling as we witness injustice, suffering, violence, is the fact that we don't know how to help, or we don't know if we can help at all, or we're convinced really that we can't help at all. So without a way to alleviate the suffering, without a way to help, why why look? Why upset ourselves by bearing witness? Compassion arises, it feels like, as a motivation to act, to help, you know, other beings. And when we can't do that, then in a way, aren't we just torturing ourselves by bearing witness? And this can be, you know, watching the news. It can be getting informed about what's going on in our community. It can be, you know, interacting with populations that have special challenges and difficulties. It can be through art. It can be through movies and documentaries and reading and stuff like that to become more familiar with what is going on in the world. It can be painful at times to bear witness, and confusing and troubling, but there are good reasons to do it. The liberation, the freedom and greater equanimity and joy and ease and intimacy promised by our practice is based in facing reality. Not escaping from it, not gaining access to some alternate realm or some spiritual state where we're untroubled. The irony is that the peace is found by directly facing reality, and this is part of reality. And one of the Buddhist images that I love is of Indra's net. So the universe is seen as just an intricate, infinitely large net, and each of us is an interstices or whatever it's called, the little places where the net crosses, and we're a little jewel, and the jewel reflects all the other jewels. So we're like, we're connected to everything, and we reflect everything, the rest of the jewels in the net. So that describes reality. So in a way, even if we ignore or deny suffering or injustice that's happening, we're kind of cutting part of ourselves off by doing it. So what about when compassion arises and we don't know how to help, or maybe we can't help? Bearing witness is still important. In fact, to truly bear witness, we need to temporarily set aside any question about how it relates to us, whether there's anything we can do or should do, or whether we're culpable or anything. We try to set aside our own concerns and questions, even if we mean well, in order to see clearly and open fully to the truth of what's in front of us. We just set aside all of these agendas. And when we do this, amazingly, we have a much greater capacity to allow whatever emotions arise to pass through. We can witness, we can respond naturally. When we're not trying to, you know, tense up or solve it or fix it or something, they can just like wash on through. It's not something that we have to hold onto. It's not something that we are responsible for in a small way. So we set aside our narratives and judgments. And this isn't to say that we suppress thoughts that arise, but we stay grounded in our perceptions. Maybe listening or watching or reading, grounded in whatever responses arise within our own body and mind, as opposed to what is very tempting, to spin up commentaries about what's right or wrong or who's to blame. You know, it's very difficult to look at some of the current events and not just immediately think, well, and, you know, get up into that commentary instead of really, you know, just directly perceiving what is most important is that beings are suffering. That's really what it comes down to. Whether they are right or wrong, whether they're to blame or not to blame for their situation, beings are suffering. They're in pain or fear, or their life potential is being crushed or something. So that is what our heart opens to. When we do this, we may feel very sad. But it's important to remember this is not the only aspect of practice or the end of practice. We don't just wallow in the sadness and give way to despair. We also take care and take action. But in the meantime, it's helpful to remember that just bearing witness, as difficult as it can be, is bodhisattva activity. As I said, we face reality. It gives us a ground for our practice. And I feel like this is important and beneficial for many other reasons. Simply through witnessing, we ensure other beings are not suffering alone. Even if there's nothing we can do, at least they are not suffering alone and anonymously. We allow for our natural compassion to arise, which increases our sense of connection with all living things. We allow ourselves to be informed, and without worrying about, for the moment, about how we can respond, or should we respond, possibilities for response may occur to us as we're in the process of bearing witness. So as we bear witness, in this case to the brokenness of our country and the brokenness of many countries around the world, as well as of our global community, if there can be said to be one, how do we avoid getting stuck in anger, hatred, outrage, despair, depression, anxiety, cynicism? And this is where taking care comes in. We need to take care of ourselves and our responsibilities in order to maintain our health and strength. Taking care is not self-indulgence. It's not deciding you're not going to bother with bearing witness or taking action because you'd rather just enjoy your life. It's not focusing on relaxation and pleasure for their own sake because you deserve it. Taking care is something we do or aim to do with full and open awareness of all the other aspects of life. It's being embodied while aspiring to fulfill the bodhisattva way to free all beings, end all delusions, enter all dharma gates, and live the Buddha way. So joy, play, and relaxation, and pleasure may come into our taking care practice, but that's not all there is to it. Within the context of our bodhisattva vows, we also need peace of mind, clarity, support, a relatively healthy lifestyle, might include exercise, eating well, getting enough sleep, maintaining relationships, taking care of the financial and material well-being of ourselves and our families, and it includes our zazen, our spiritual practice, and our participation in sangha. Our overall health, as I'm sure many people here today can appreciate, can profoundly affect our state of mind and heart as we face what's going on in the world or in our personal lives. When we're strong, we feel like we can deal with just about anything. When we're weakened, it's easy to sink into a negative state from which it's difficult to escape. One of the best ways to take care when bearing witness is making us depressed or angry or fearful is, of course, to ground ourselves in this moment. We do this in our zazen. And we do this in our mindfulness practice throughout the day. Just pausing and taking a few breaths can help us do this. This is recognizing the independent dimension of reality, also known as the absolute aspect of reality. The independent dimension of reality the dependent dimension being of time and space and causality, and the independent dimension being essentially dimensionless, right here, right now. This is just one seamless reality with a lot of parts. So, right here, right now, we are, the vast majority of the time, okay. Whatever's coming, right now, we're at peace, we're warm, we're fed, we're with Sangha, we're okay. We may imagine all kinds of terrible possible scenarios unfolding in the future, but the truth is we don't know what's going to happen. There is a sense in which everything is just as it is. Suzuki Roshi's things as it is. Despite everything, it's a miracle life even exists. There are infinitely many reasons to be grateful at this moment. We're just usually blind to them because we're all wrapped up in self-concern and agendas. Obsession with the past or future. So the longer we practice, the more we sit zazen and practice mindfulness, the deeper our personal experience of this independent dimension of reality. It becomes as real as the dependent dimension. Not just a comforting thought or a philosophical notion. Perception of the independent dimension becomes a touchstone that's accessible to us at any moment. But the relief provided by the perception of the independent dimension does not in any way, shape, or form relieve us of our bodhisattva responsibilities. It doesn't even make the sadness go away when we bear witness. It just makes us stronger, so we're more capable of experiencing that, of holding that, without succumbing to hatred or depression or despair. And we become more capable of the other essential ingredient in our practice, taking action. So as I said earlier, Zen doesn't tell us what we should do to enact our bodhisattva vows in the world. It doesn't tell us how to address injustice, how to save our democracy, how to avoid the catastrophic effects of climate change. It doesn't tell us how to make sure truth triumphs over blatant lies and conspiracy theories, or how to end the culture war, or prevent dictators from taking over the world. And maybe it's a bummer that our spiritual tradition doesn't give us more answers to questions like these, but I think we should be happy that it doesn't. If it did, those answers would quickly become irrelevant and limited and perhaps even dangerous. Because the world is a complex and ever-changing set of circumstances. The best answers and responses, such as they are going to arise through us, alive and participating, bearing witness, taking care, aspiring to the bodhisattva way, learning, adapting, and doing our best. And practice equips us for that participation. So taking action means what? It isn't limited to going into the streets to protest, or volunteering for political campaigns, or working within an organization aimed at positive social change. Although all of these are definitely ways of taking action, and I hope you will all consider participating in them. And taking action is also not limited to being nice to your family members and greeting the grocery store clerk in a friendly way. We're just devoting your conscience and devoting and donating to good causes. First and foremost, taking action means openness. openness to manifesting generosity with your time and energy and resources. Openness to participation and engagement with the world instead of sitting on the sidelines. Openness to learning new things and exploring new territory. Openness to the possibility that what you do matters. And the possibility that you aren't doing everything you can yet. And open to the infinite ways we together can make the world a better place. So you may not know how to take action in response to the brokenness of our country. And that's understandable. And even when we find a way to respond, that's not the end of it. Things change and a different response becomes required. But we must avoid passivity simply because we don't see a way forward. We won't find a way forward unless we're looking for it. Unless we're engaged, open, curious, and willing. A beneficial and positive response is unlikely to just come knocking on our door. We need to go out and look for it. And as we look for our way to respond, according to our capacity, we must remember we're only part of Indra's net. Whatever we do will only be a small contribution. But if every aspiring bodhisattva did something, we'd make an awesome difference. Once we've found something to do, some small way to work for positive change in the world, freeing beings from suffering, ending delusions, affirming life, strengthening democracy, improving education, the list goes on. It's essential to let go of attachment to results and base our motivation in love. If we think too much about whether we're making a difference or whether it's likely what we hope for will be achieved, we will be quickly discouraged. And we should make some kind of discerning choice in what we choose to do. Just anything. I mean, we try to choose something that we think will be beneficial. But ultimately, we continue doing that because we're simply manifesting our bodhisattva vow. Participating in a flow of life energy and generosity. Because that's how we want to live. Even if there's little hope of success, we take action because it's the right thing to do. So in summary, practice means living deliberately. That means we turn toward reality. We turn toward challenges. So if we're feeling distress and fear and worry or whatever about the state of the world, we turn toward that experience and ask, how can we make this into practice? How can we engage this situation in the interest of our bodhisattva vows? And Zen doesn't tell us what to do, but it prepares us to respond in a way that fulfills our greatest potential. And if we include the three ingredients, or however you want to divide them up, but the bearing witness, taking care, and taking action, we can live sustainable, even joyful, generous lives. And I guess the main take-home message is we must not give up. That is not what bodhisattvas do. That is one of the core definitions of a bodhisattva, is that they just keep going. Their vows are impossible. Their vows are infinite. And there's story after story in the texts about bodhisattvas looking out and seeing like they haven't made any progress at all. And they're just about to get discouraged, but they go on. Because ultimately that's, you know, it's about how we are choosing to live. So that's what I have to offer today. I will leave it there and open it up for comments and questions. As usual, those on Zoom, if you want to click reactions and raise a hand, that's the easiest thing. Or you can raise your hand or unmute yourself and change the setting on the little microphone here for the Zendo. I'll say we'll just sit quietly for a minute and until something arises. Phil.
I really enjoyed the talk. Very practical and kind of to the point, and I think a very helpful perspective. So, thank you.
Hi, Domio. Hi there. First and foremost, I just can't even believe that you came up with all that so eloquently and so succinctly and so spot on in just like no time at all. It really did feel, and I use the word feel intentionally, it felt like something that you had worked on for a month or two. I mean, it was just truly spectacular. So thank you first and foremost for that. I guess less of a question is just more, I feel like it really captured so much of what so many of us are feeling. And I think this week, especially, I feel like there's so many weeks that I could say this week, especially yet another week where especially we sort of had a moment of like, ah, hell, you know, and then you think, should I just ditch this place? And then you look at, you know, protests in the Netherlands and the far right gaining ground in France. And you just think, you know, the grass is always greener. And then I was thinking about the spot at the end, you know, you're just sort of talking about the Bodhisattva vow and, you know, really feeling like you never get anywhere. And that's absolutely true, which makes me feel like, damn it, I'm not going to give up. So, and this is my home and this is my place. And no matter where I go, I'm going to have problems. So anyways, just thank you so much for what you said. It gave me a lot to sit and feel with over the weekend.
Thank you. And I would say that in a sense, I've probably been working on this talk for years, maybe a couple decades. Hopefully every time it comes out, it's not, you know, it's a little bit different, a little bit better. I'm Brian.
So part of what I've been reflecting on recently in light of these events is that, you know, part of bearing witness is also, I think, witnessing the perpetrator of violence, in the sense that realizing that, you know, sort of I am him. And part of what has brought this home to me is that I've been involuntarily exposed to a lot of rap music over the last several months. And, you know, as anyone who's had even a casual exposure to it will be struck by its violence and its misogyny and so forth. And you may be more inclined to kind of understand where that has come from, threat to selfhood, self-worth, and how it generates an exaggerated imaginary move to power and as a compensatory. And I think that, you know, when we, especially as Kyle Rittenhouse, you know, who was 16 years old when he, you know, went to this demonstration and wounded grievously one person and killed two others, was really just was a kid who had adopted this identity. It's, you know, I think, at least I've tried to feel, you know, what is, you know, what in me would be that kid if I had grown up as he did and had been subjected to or been exposed to the influences that he has. And, you know, so, you know, it's not enough, obviously, to do that because, you know, threats to identity have often been the machinery of oppression here and elsewhere. But I do think it is a, it feels like an inescapable place to start if there is a healing to be had for the brokenness. You know, because while we may look at the violence of that moment in that episode, that's not all who he is. In the same way that people who do a prison ministry appreciate that whether someone is confined because of a moment of violence, that's not all of who he or she is. And, you know, there, it is, I'm sure, very difficult to disentangle sympathizing with a person, identifying with a person, and not enabling and validating the violence. But I do, and I don't know how people do that well, but I do think that that is a part of where we are now is sort of disentangling the consequences of violence, the less noble passions that are aroused and lead to it from these other dimensions of personhood, you know, that we probably do want to bear witness to and identify with.
Thank you. I think that's a great example of turning toward the feelings and the reactions and the distress and the events and saying, you know, how can we make this into practice? With something that I can learn here, what is some way to move toward some greater acceptance of the situation or compassion. And I do think it's like, I find that one of the most useful teachings of Buddhism is that all beings are suffering and essentially any hateful, destructive, selfish action comes out of suffering and delusion. That's not to excuse it in any way. You know, we need to do what we have to do in order to keep people safe and, you know, fight for justice if we can. But I guess for me, I guess you might think, well, who cares whether we feel any kind of compassion for people like Rittenhouse? But the experience of it as practice is it actually hurts not to have compassion for him, to have no space, to only feel hatred and confusion and fear and misunderstanding it hurts, it's stressful, it's painful, it's confusing. So actually being able to find that space is to our advantage as well. So Choketsu, are you raising your hand?
Yeah, I could put it there and then it disappears. I'm not sure what's going on. But
I think you're just using the applause button instead of the raise hand button, which stays there. So you're just going like, yay.
Oh, I see. Raise hand is at the bottom. Okay. Yeah, yeah. All right. Sorry.
Thank you for the applause, though.
I did mean applause. And hopefully everybody learned that. Maybe nobody's made that mistake before. I don't know.
No.
But I know listening to you talking about bearing witness, that felt and feels very natural to me. Even before I became a Buddhist, I strongly believed in that. You know, watching movies. I didn't like violence. I mean, I don't like to watch movies that have violence. But bearing witness by seeing movies and reading stories about people who have suffered, I've always felt that that was important. And my partner hates to do that. he wants to protect himself and, you know, not get depressed and all that stuff, and he doesn't get it. There was a while there that I got involved with battered women in the Hillsborough area, and I've trained as an advocate for them. Again, before Buddhism, but so that was an action. I was just going to say, I'm good at bearing witness, not so good at taking care, and not so good at taking action, but then that occurred to me that I did do that some years ago. I don't know. I don't go out into society much anymore because I'm used to staying home now, and I don't know how to re-engage, really. It's really strange. And I'm, 10, 15 years older now, too. What I can do that's useful, I don't know. But I'm going to work on that. That's all. Thank you.
Yeah, I think I'm still working on the whole taking action part, because I think it's so easy for us to have limited ideas about how that might look and then feel inadequate or guilty because we're not doing enough. And I don't know, I think it's something that I would love for the Sangha to explore more together, to just say, I'm trying to do this, I aspire to do this, I don't really know what to do, I'm trying this doesn't quite feel right, I don't, what is it really? And I think I got closer in today's talk than I have in the past. Just this sense of openness, this kind of sense of generosity, so that, and curiosity. So I guess I kind of imagine, say you wandered into a emergency situation, there's just been a car accident or something, and you wander onto the scene, you don't know what you can do, but you're willing to help. So you just kind of look around and see what you can do. So it feels kind of like that attitude. Not like, well, if I take action, it's got to be like this, or it's got to be this long, or it's got to be this committed or something, but just more of this, I don't know. And then you hear about something, right? You hear about somebody who's running for local office who seems cool and they need help, or, maybe you could do some flyers for them and for some writing or editing or bookkeeping or who knows what. I don't know, this Saturday, not so yeah, the, this next Saturday, the 27th, for instance, one of the things I'm doing, I'm going to go out and do a Red Rebel action. And we are going to, so the Red Rebel Brigade, I did a video of them. We all dress up in red and we're like, we remain silent. And we, it's like a theater. And we're going to go to Clackamas Town Center and do this Red Rebel action, like until they make us leave. Which we don't know what that's going to look like, but when they come up to make us leave, like the reds, we will remain in character. We have an ambassador who will speak to the security guard or whatever, and then the ambassador will explain, like, well, we have to stay in character as we leave, so we'll leave very, very slowly. But that's like, you know, what does that do? I guess, you know, it's hard to put your finger on it, but it's, I like to think that as we move through that mall and there's people in there out doing their shopping, and then they just stop and they're like, what is that? And then we hand them a little flyer that says what we're about, and that, you know, even though we just had COP26, we're still not on course to avert climate catastrophe, and just a little bit, you know, it, making it appear in people's lives more often so that it becomes more part of people's consciousness. So I don't know who was first, Ruth Ann. I think Ruth Ann unmuted and then Pat. So Ruth Ann, do you have something you wanna say?
Thank you. Even for a non-techie person like myself, we can use the devices to be aware of what's happening locally, like your event next Saturday, even if we're not joining it, but pay attention to local issues around climate. And I think it was someone speaking a few weeks back at our Dharma talks, not yourself, but a person saying, well, relationships, when we're working on them, they get messy and they're not easy. I mean, we're human beings. So to me, that's like being in the mud, and out of the mud, of course, comes the lotus flower. And like Joanna Macy said, even if we think our action isn't going to bring results we want, we add to our psyche in a balanced way that we're doing something. Thank you for this talk.
Thank you. Pat?
I over the last 90 days, I have encountered an opportunity that is more related to our three points of bearing witness, taking care, and taking action. My sister-in-law is what I decided to call her, announced on Facebook that she was addicted to methamphetamine and she was going to go into rehab. And she announced it to everybody, I think, so she couldn't get out of it. But she's the mother of our niece. And our niece is my husband's brother's daughter as well. And somehow I was able to perceive that this was an opportunity to step up. And I really did not know Becky very well. I'd been to, you know, picnics and stuff with her, but it has allowed me a couple of times to step up and notice that it has now been 90 days since she went into detox, and she's had encountered some stuff that actually I'm most interested in her well-being right now, but I certainly feel like I could take on the whole rehab organization, because sometimes what everybody's trying to do isn't making it easier. It isn't making it helpful sometimes. And I've been up close and personal and in this situation. And it is an opportunity. And I think sometimes I don't see those opportunities, or I can see refugees who have to leave their country, and I can feel the compassion, but I can't get close to it in a way that I can see how I can be helpful. So I think I'm just sharing that that I've gotten such an incredible opportunity to be her friend. One of the things that I have done is text her good morning and good night every single day with little message, except that I'm thinking about you and good night, have a good night's sleep. And so I guess I feel pretty blessed that the opportunity came to me. And because there are times when you share the bearing witness, taking care and taking action, and I think I can't think of how to do something concrete. And so I came close, I think, to volunteering to be on the board of one of the residential facilities. I was quite miffed with their inaction. So that's more involved than I many, many times get. But I wanted to share it because it's been a profound experience for me for 90 days. And it looks like we're going to continue our friendship while she continues to go through these challenges, which are not easy. She did, my big success is she did get enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan, and she got on food stamps, and she now has an apartment. And that really did take about 90 days to get those three things in place. So I'm happy about that.
Thank you for sharing, Pat. And I think that's a perfect example of Sangha sharing about this and it becoming more clear to everybody the different ways that this can manifest, and also that sense of, like, if we have that openness and curiosity, like you were talking about, like you've been studying the bearing witness, taking care, taking action for a while, and like, all right, you know, what would I do? And then, you know, something presents itself, and it's usually like one thing leads to another. You know, then you're curious about this, and you recognize your skills could be used here, and then, you know, sometimes that path will see itself out. You know, you've gone down that path for a while, and then you got to kind of go back to the drawing board. Like, I spent the last year and a half on a particular climate organization that I'm like, well, enough with that. Now I'm on to something different. But you know, it's but I learned a lot and did a lot in the meantime. So thank you for sharing that. All right, I will close with our verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna arahant. Thank you all for coming.